dealing with evidence for Christ's deity. And after we finish this, we'll go into evidence for the Bible being God's Word. And you guys attend the sermon I gave on the Shroud of Turin? Were you here for that?
Years ago.
Because I want to add that to the historical apologetics course, but if you guys have had it already and don't feel the need to go over that, then we'll just close with the evidence for the Bible as God's Word. And but when we like publish this as a produce it as a course and audio cassettes, we'll just add a couple of the lectures that I did on the Shroud of Turin. So, but whatever the case, I wouldn't use the, I think I said this before in this course, but I wouldn't use the Shroud of Turin as evidence for the historical Jesus or for Christ's deity in a particular debate, only because it would take at least 2 hours to even give a tip of the iceberg defense of the Shroud of Turin, and you probably only have 2 hours to make a defense of the deity of Christ or the historicity of Christ, whatever it is. So it just wouldn't be effective in that sense. But in witnessing, I found the Shroud of Turin is, it's such a good witnessing tool. If you're reading a book on the Shroud of Turin and it's got a picture on the cover, it's not uncommon for people to just stop. Like if you were reading one at Barnes & Noble or at the in the food court in the mall, I wouldn't be surprised if people would just walk up to you and say, "What's that?" And and pretty much they know it's Jesus's face, but they're wondering, "Why does it look that way? What's going on here?" And then I just tell people, some people believe this is the burial cloth of Christ, and that somehow his image was miraculously left on it when he rose from the dead. And you'd be surprised, when I worked in the sub-base police department, how many people were very cold to the gospel. But once I said that, they wanted to know more. And so it's
a curiosity.
Yeah. Now, Ravi Zacharias reported that, and I don't know if the information is reliable. I don't have any reason to doubt its reliability because Zacharias is a pretty squared away guy. But he, in one of his books, he said that Elvis Presley died. He was found dead, laying on the floor, with an open Bible in one hand and an open book on the Shroud of Turin in the other hand.
Sure, it wasn't a Twinkie.
So yeah, no, he had to power all the Twinkies there, but so hopefully he was searching. And he didn't footnote it in his book, so it was kind of like, how do I check this out? Will you go on the internet and search for Elvis / Shroud?
When they used to do the tours, I don't think they do it anymore. But they mentioned the Bible. But the Shroud of Turin is
I could find the book that Ravi Zacharias. That would take me 10 minutes to figure out which book it was and find it. I think it was the second one that he wrote. But I'm pretty sure he doesn't footnote it. So, you'd probably have to write him a letter or something to try to trace it back. But now, John A.T. Robinson, the liberal scholar who wrote Honest to God, and then became an evangelical Christian and wrote Redating the New Testament, where he had a radical view. He believed every New Testament book was written before 70 AD by a circumcised Jew, which I don't know what he does with Luke, and certainly there seems to be a few books that were written after 70 AD, but apparently one of the key factors in the transformation of his life was the Shroud of Turin. And both Geisler and Habermas in their works document that. So Okay, so we're talking about evidence for Jesus' deity. Did we already talk about, I know we talked about the evidence for Jesus' resurrection from this, from the orange sheet. Did we talk about the evidence for Christ's deity as far as the New Testament scholars? Yeah, that he's calling God, Abba, his own father, things of that sort. Well, and so basically, New Testament scholarship, they've rejected explicit Christology, basically where Jesus explicitly claimed to be God. They say, well, obviously Jesus really never said that. So they just throw these passages out, like, I and the Father are one, he who has seen me has seen the Father, before Abraham was born I am. But even in just through Christ's actions and his words, even what he implies, you still end up in the same area. And that's the issues that now New Testament scholars are dealing with. And whatever the case, we talked about the fact that Jesus claimed to be God, and that the apostles called Jesus God, the pupils of the apostles who led the early church, the apostolic fathers, called Jesus God. I just tell them, like, in history of Christian thought class today, that I'm starting to think that there was, we see the apostolic fathers as an immediate link to the apostles, because they were the pupils of the apostles, that the apostles selected to lead the early church. It seems, though, that Papias seems to talk about a group even closer to the apostles than the apostolic fathers. And he calls them the elders, and he also calls them the disciples of the Lord. And the apostles are also included in that group. So it may be that the 70 elders that Jesus trained face-to-face, though not as thoroughly as the 12 apostles, were probably 12 of those 70. It seems that the other 58, in other words, after the apostles died, the apostles were not, most of them were not living to be very old, because they were, you know, being put to death. But the other 58 disciples of the Lord are probably not as well known, and were not targeted by the Roman Empire or the Jewish religious leaders. And apparently from probably around 70 AD to about 95 AD, when you have kind of the beginning date of the apostolic fathers as far as their writings, with Clement of Rome in 96 AD, that you may have had these elders who were actually of the 70 disciples of the Lord. They're getting old at this time, but you know, you'll have a guy like Papias, who's an apostolic father, who'll say, well, if I have any question that needs to be settled, I can go to the disciples, you know, who knew the apostles. And so even after the apostles died, there was still a group held in even higher esteem than the apostolic fathers. It's kind of like the elders or the other disciples were like brothers, spiritually speaking. They were brothers of the apostles, same age, contemporaries, whereas the apostolic fathers were the young guys that were trained to be the leaders of the next generation. So so you would think, by putting a link between the apostolic fathers and the apostles, you would think that would lessen the authority of the apostolic fathers, but in reality it strengthens it, because these guys were contemporaries of the apostles and were continuing that witness. Aristian or something like that, Aristion? Yeah, he's one of the ones that he mentioned, so these are some pretty radical dudes. But whatever the case, even ancient secular authors wrote that first century Christians worshiped Jesus as God. The ancient creeds, which predate the New Testament, called Jesus God. So he said that our choices are, you know, he couldn't just merely be a good man. You can't say, well, this guy, he's a good man, he just claims to be God all the time. claim to be God, you're either God or you're insane or you're a liar. And the whole legend hypothesis is just ruled out, as we argued for the historical reliability of the New Testament manuscripts, and then as we argued for Christ's resurrection, the evidence for Christ's resurrection. So, and just the fact, what we listed here, the apostles calling Jesus God, apostolic fathers, ancient creeds, that rules out the legend hypothesis. So either he was a liar, insane, or he was telling the truth, and he is God. And we already talked about last week that that Jesus was not a liar. The most recognized that he taught the highest standards of morality ever taught, that he had a positive impact on mankind like no other man, that his love and compassion for his fellow man does not fit the profile of a selfish liar. And but the ultimate evidence that Jesus Christ was not lying and that he was who he claimed to be was God putting the stamp of approval on his teachings by raising him from the dead. And we've already shown that you can make a strong historical case for Jesus rising from the dead. So the resurrection itself, you know, why would God raise a liar from the dead? Now, what I tell my, after I go through this, you know, process of elimination, where we end up with, okay, Jesus was telling the truth, he is God. What I tell my students at King's West now is that in the end, when everything's said and done, probably the three strongest evidences for Christ's deity are his miracles, his resurrection, which was the greatest of his miracles, and the Old Testament prophecies that he fulfilled. I don't really know why, but for some reason, New Testament scholars are more open today to acknowledging that in some sense of the word, and they don't always claim to fully understand what it means, but in some sense, he did perform miracles. And more scholars are either acknowledging that he did rise from the dead, or will give you enough. Like they'll give you, they'll acknowledge the empty tomb was historical, that the earliest preaching preached the resurrection, that the apostles really believed they saw Jesus risen from the dead. So though they may not acknowledge the resurrection, they give you so much that it's practically the same thing as giving you the resurrection. So miracles and the resurrection aren't usually that big of a problem with New Testament critics, but very rarely will you find New Testament critics will even look into the Old Testament prophecies fulfilled by Christ. It's almost universally assumed by non-believing New Testament critics that the early church read into the Old Testament the prophecies that Jesus fulfilled. And I think that's for two reasons. Number one, and I'm just guesstimating here, but number one, you have your Old Testament scholars and you have your New Testament scholars. And if they want to remain non-believers, it would be best if they don't communicate a lot with one another. But they start communicating with one another, and the case for Christ is going to get stronger. And so I don't think they really communicate too well. It's kind of like a geologist who's an evolutionist and an astronomer who's an evolutionist. The astronomer is convinced that evolution is true, but he thinks that that's proved in geology. And the geologist is convinced that evolution is true, but he knows the evidence is in his field, so he thinks you go to astronomy. But they don't communicate enough for them to see that, you know, neither one has the answer. But the other problem that I mentioned, the reason why they believe that the early church read some of the messianic prophecies into the Old Testament is because the Bible of the first-generation church, since the gospel spread among Hellenistic Jews and among Greeks, was the Greek Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. And a lot of the prophecies that they claim that Jesus fulfilled have a different reading in the Hebrew Bible than they do in the Greek Septuagint. Now, when the author of Hebrews, if the author of Hebrews really was inspired by God, and I believe he was, if he quotes it from the Septuagint, then that tells me the Septuagint is probably a more reliable translation, at least in that passage, than the Hebrew Bible that we have today. And what's the oldest Old Testament manuscripts that we have? I'm not saying oldest Hebrew. Oldest Hebrew actually the Dead Sea Scrolls, but there's really, you know, fragments of this, fragments of that. But the complete thing is the Masoretic text, which goes, what, 10th century A.D. But the oldest Old Testament manuscripts, regardless of the language, Septuagint. So you could make a case that the Septuagint was probably translated from a much older and much more reliable Hebrew text than anything we have today.
And then the translators knew the language better than the translators today because they weren't around at that time to understand the language.
That's a good point, and I'll add one more point to it. And this is one that I don't like to shout from the rooftops, and it's something that I had just from dealing with informed Orthodox Jewish people, trying to talk with them about Jesus and the way they reinterpret messianic prophecies. There seems to be a little bit of a sleight of hand, and so I was open to the possibility that ancient rabbis actually had the audacity to just come right out and change a few passages if that's what they had to do, so it didn't look like Jesus fulfilled it. And then I found that that's exactly what Justin Martyr that was actually one of his arguments. And now we're talking like 170 AD with a Jewish rabbi, and Justin Martyr argued that, you know, you Jewish religious leaders have changed your text. Here are the older readings, and these were fulfilled by Christ, and you changed them. So like in Hebrews, the author of Hebrews says that, you know, you have prepared a body for me, and you know, it was written about me in the scroll, you have prepared a body for me, you no longer require animal, you're not pleased with animal sacrifices, so a body you have prepared for me, it was written about me in the scroll. Obviously messianic. You go back to the Hebrew Old Testament, and it says, it was written about me in the scroll, and you're not pleased with animal sacrifices, but my ears you have pierced. So, you know, just throw out a body you have prepared for me. So, I would guess sometimes it's just like in Psalm 22, where the text hasn't been changed, but they just chose to translate it like a lion, my hands and my feet, rather than they pierced my hands and my feet. But in some places it appears to be just an outright changing of the passage. Yeah, Mark?
Well, I have a parallel Hebrew Old Testament, and at the beginning, before it goes into the text, he makes two very strange points. And one of them that I remember clearly was the word Alma. I mean, out of all of the Hebrew words in the Bible, he picks on that one. And instead of translating it betrothed version, he says everyone knows, and he's assuming that everyone knows, that the word should be translated to young woman and not virgin. But it's interesting that in the Septuagint, you know, gentlemen who know the Hebrew language better than he did use the Greek word prophetos for the word Alma.
Yeah, and that's of course you're alluding to Isaiah 7:14, and even when Matthew, who had to know a little bit about Hebrew himself, when he quotes it, of course he could have been quoting the Septuagint. That argument could be made, but he uses the word for virgin. But whatever the case, Dr. Henson from Liberty University, one of my former professors there, who's probably Jerry Falwell's right-hand man at Liberty University, and I can't remember the name of the other scholar, if his name was Young. I think his name was Young, who wrote a three-volume commentary on the book of Isaiah, and he spends about 100 pages arguing that, rightly understood, Alma is actually a stronger word for virgin in that particular context.
Right, because it means betrothed virgin.
Yeah.
Which means not only was she a virgin, but she was betrothed at the time.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's a lot of idiosyncrasies involved, but in the end, it's actually a stronger word for it. And I mean, you know, are we going to say, well, can we say that the Hebrew scholars who translated the Old Testament Hebrew Bible into Greek and the Greek Septuagint, are we going to say, number one, they didn't know their Hebrew? You know, good luck with that. Or are we going to say, number two, well, they were biased, they were going to trying to like make Christianity look good 200 years before it came into existence. I mean, what argument are you going to use against them for translating it as virgin? And as Charlesworth has gone on record out of Princeton, the chairman of their biblical studies department, he is not an evangelical. Did I say Charleston? Charlesworth. But he's gone on record as saying that Matthew and Luke had no incentive to invent a virgin birth story. So, I mean, because it gives too much ammunition to your opponents, so he argues that they had to really, it was considered accepted data, historical data, before they wrote it. Now, Charlesworth isn't saying that it's true, because he's, you know, not exactly an evangelical, but basically what he's saying is, you know, you can't say that Matthew and Luke made that up. Whoever wrote Matthew, whoever wrote Luke, because Charlesworth probably isn't sure himself, although he's arguing for it. He's not arguing for it, but he's saying that it's possible that John's Gospel was written in the 50s, early to mid-50s A.D. So, I mean, some of these non-evangelical scholars are saying some radical things, but whatever the case, you know, so you can't even blame the New Testament authors and say, well, they just misunderstood Isaiah because of the Septuagint, a poor translation there. You know, I mean, it's a tough case to make, to argue against.
It's a tough case to make anyway, because when Jerome translated it from the Hebrew, he used the Latin virgo for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Latin word for a virgin also.
Mm-hmm.
It could be translated maiden, but it's specifically virgin, because the Romans had the concept of that too.
And of course, the big issue with Jerome was he was big on the original languages, which is really interesting, because once he translated the Latin Vulgate, for centuries, you made your translations from the Vulgate. You didn't go to... So it's kind of the guy who in early church history was the biggest on, let's go to the original languages. People stopped going to the original languages and went to him. To a certain degree, even though you want to translate directly from the original... But since Jerome was such a great scholar, you know, you might actually be better off, because you might make some blunders you didn't make. So you could actually see some incentive especially as Greek became less and less, Greek and Hebrew became less and less common. Yeah, so that would just be another argument, that here's the scholar who knows the Greek, the Hebrew in depth, knows the Latin in depth, and he translates it a word that could only be used for virgin. So they also argue, Dr. Henson and Dr. Young also argue that okay, conservative scholars usually argue today that when in Isaiah 7:14, it's not only a prediction of the Messiah, but it's also a prediction of a son who was going to be born during the lifetime of Isaiah. So there's a double fulfillment there, and so the conservative scholars say that's why God chose to use the more vague term for virgin, because it doesn't apply to the other guy that was born contemporaneously with Isaiah. But what Hinson and Young argue is the only reason why we hold to the double fulfillment is because liberal scholars had already claimed that they had made their case for this baby being born during the time of Isaiah, so it couldn't refer to Jesus. And so the conservative scholars said, okay, well, you're right about that, but it still doesn't take away Jesus as the ultimate fulfillment. And what Dr. Young and Dr. Henson are saying is that conservative scholars should have never made that concession. And so they go to the context, the surrounding chapters, and argue that there's only one fulfillment, and it's in Jesus of Nazareth. So it's not even, there's not even a double fulfillment there at all. And by conservatives conceding a point we should not have conceded, it opened the door. You know, it basically gave our opponents enough rope to hang us with. And whatever the case, even when you look at the New Testament, I mean the Old Testament as we have it today, even if there were some changes made to it to water down the messianic prophecies that Christ fulfilled. I mean, if you can get the Hebrew and English translation of the Hebrew Bible today, and the case for Jesus fulfilling the Old Testament prophecies probably only loses maybe 5-7% of its force in their translation than it does in ours. I mean, it's just, you go to the messianic passages and it's like, whoa, they don't see this, you know.
Well, one of the other things I've heard is an argument for using the Septuagint in the New Testament as direct quotation is for the same reason that you would probably use the King James Version if you were to stop your argument and then quote the verse, and you would use the official translation for that verse, and then you go back to your normal usage.
You know, it's funny. The only Old Testament prophecy quoted in context or exactly in the New Testament is, my God, why have you forsaken me? Word for word.
Yeah. that's the only one, like quoted, like word for
exactly
word from the Hebrew
word.
Old.
When Christ says, my God, my God, why have you forsaken me on the cross? In the Psalm, says, I think it's the Psalm. That's the only one that's in context.
Right.
They're exactly word for word.
You read about
in the New Testament, they quote Old Testament passages, and it's always not exactly.
Not exactly, yeah.
But the only one is the one Christ uttered.
Yeah, that's interesting. And the it also makes a strong case for maybe we ought to look a lot closer at the... See, the thing is, with the Septuagint, in our translations, we always translate in Psalm 22, they pierced my hands and my feet. Yet the Hebrew Bible does not read that way. It's like a lion, my hands and my feet. But it doesn't make any sense.
But if you change the dots, I mean, the tables, you could probably do it. I'm sure. I should see if I can do that.
What's that?
The vowels.
Mm-hmm.
If you insert the proper vowels, I think you can come up with the other one.
With the lion, right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's what my understanding is in that particular passage. The text, the Hebrew text, wasn't changed. Yeah, they either did that or grouped the words a little differently just to cloud the meaning. It's like they would rather have a meaningless passage in the Old Testament than a passage that was clearly fulfilled by Christ. And but there's an example where the translators said that the Septuagint, makes sense. So let's go with the Septuagint here rather than with the standard Hebrew text. And yeah.
Oh, Jerome himself had to do that a few times too. I'm sure, because that's why he had to make two versions of the Psalms.
Yeah.
He made one that's directly translated from the Hebrew. He also made one directly translated from the Septuagint.
Yeah.
So that there's no argument with that.
Let me see if I can find that passage in Hebrews too, just to show you how clear a passage is. And you know, yeah, later tonight when you get a chance, or tomorrow or whatever, you could just look up the cross references and see how it's been kind of butchered in the Hebrew. Wondering.
Wonder what to do with Zechariah 12, where Jehovah speaks and says, "He will look upon me when they are confused."
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think they changed that much.
It's a puzzle to them.
Yeah, yeah. There's quite a few. There's quite a few passages that for all practical purposes are left just the way they used to be in the Hebrew Old Testament. And Hebrews 10, starting at verse 5, it says, "Therefore," talking about Christ, "therefore, when he came into the world, he said, 'Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but a body you have prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you had no pleasure. Then I said, Behold, I have come. In the volume of the book it is written of me to do your will, O God.'" I mean, that's just like, that's got the incarnation written all over it. And the incarnation for the purpose of providing the truly efficient sacrifice for man's sins, and that the Old Testament scrolls their focus is on this person who's going to be in take bodily form and redeem man. Now, when you go back to where that's quoted, which is Psalm 40, verses 6 to 8, and instead of, "But a body you have prepared for me," it's something along the lines of, "My ears you have opened, my ears you have pierced." So it's like, you know, it seems that sometime after the translation of the Greek, of the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek in the Septuagint, 200 years before Christ, sometime after that, which I would say, you know, probably right after the years directly following Christ's death and resurrection, sometime after that, certain passages were retranslated that don't really seem to make much sense anymore, but the way they had been translated earlier were very clear prophecies of the Messiah.
You'll see in some translations, like in the NIV, they'll put a subtitle underneath it. It'll say, "See the Septuagint."
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was the hint right there. The other Hebrews probably pointing to the Septuagint, but this translation of the Psalm is from the Hebrew.
Yeah, and we will the general rule in translating the Hebrew, translating the Old Testament, is the general rule in all translations, you try to go to the original languages. You can make a case. If motives are taken out of the picture, you can make a case that among a community that speaks that language, that is their language, and among a community, 1,000 years later, they will probably have a more accurate translation in the original language than if you had a translation, you know, a translation of that writing into a different language, like just 200 years, 300 years later. So generally speaking, as long as because all they have to do is just copy. They're just copying the same letters, the same words, and passing it down from generation to generation. But immediately when you have to translate, the first question that comes to mind, does the guy know the Hebrew that he's translating from? Or maybe he knows the Hebrew real well, but doesn't know the Greek real well. So maybe he didn't do a real good job. Then again, maybe he knows the Greek real well, but he doesn't know the Hebrew real well. So again, he has to know both real well just to do a good job in translation. And then even when you do a good job, when you translate, automatically you will lose something in the translation. And even if you do a really good job, you say, okay, this particular word, I know that it means this word in the Greek or whatever. So you translate that Hebrew word into this Greek word. But it might be that Greek word could also be have several other meanings. And later scholars might not know that without knowing what it said in the Hebrew. So generally speaking, Bible translators are correct to go to the primary source, the most reliable Hebrew text that we have. Having said that, someone of the stature in ancient times of Justin Martyr was making the case with a leading Jewish rabbi of his day that, you know that your rabbis have retranslated a few passages or changed a few texts or whatever. So, and then when we see that we have evidence that the Septuagint, you know, well, we know the Septuagint differed and it was translated so far back, it's enough to raise a question. So Bible translators are putting little footnotes down. And, you know, and especially when the text in the Hebrew makes no sense, and then you find out the text in the Septuagint makes perfect sense, was quoted in the New Testament and was messianic and fulfilled by Christ. So, I mean, we're talking about the same Pharisees and scribes that witnessed Jesus' miracles and said, okay, we have to acknowledge he's casting out demons, so let's just say that he's doing it by the power of Satan. So if they will go to that extreme, I think we ought to be at least open to the possibility that, you know, maybe some other changes were made. Now, let me tell you the normal way that Old Testament prophecies are dealt with by knowledgeable Orthodox Jews today. Now, keep in mind, it's sad to say, but the average Orthodox Jew is a lot like the average Christian thinker. The average Christian thinker doesn't always spend a lot of time in the Bible, spends a lot of time reading commentators on the Bible or theologians about the Bible. So, in other words, I'm not slamming Calvinists, I think they have some of the best scholars there are, but most Calvinists know Calvin better, and Calvin and Augustine better than they know the Bible. And the same can be said for Baptists, with Chafer, and, you know, it's just human nature being what it is. rather than just reading God's Word and trying to study it, and then reading these other guys on the side, we kind of say, well, instead of doing my homework, trying to figure out what God's saying here, let me see what other guys said. Other guys have said that they think God's saying, and I'll just go with it.
And
I think it's a humility. It's a sign of humility when a pastor says, I'm not as brilliant as Charles Ryrie, and he's been studying the Word longer than I've been alive, so I'm going to look and see what the Ryrie Study Bible says before I write my sermon up, you know? So I think that's fine. But if we're going to believe it because Ryrie said it, then even Ryrie's going to get upset. If we're going to believe it because Calvin said it, even Calvin gets upset. So, but the fact of the matter is, a lot of times when we're talking to Jews about Messianic prophecies, we're talking with them about something they never read. A lot of times we're talking with Jews about, talking to Jews who have spent their time, if they've done any reading in the Talmud, which basically is the Jewish commentary on the Old Testament. And guess what? If the rabbis who wrote the Talmud rejected Jesus as the Messiah, you think they're going to focus on Messianic prophecies in the Old Testament? Probably not. You're probably going to find more of their focus on the technicalities of the laws, and just as the opponents of Jesus were. And lo and behold, that's what we find today. But just generally, what they will say is like, okay, I'll give you an example. Isaiah 53. There you have one of the clearest Old Testament prophecies of Jesus, the suffering Messiah. And to look at Isaiah 53, starts, who has believed our report? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? So 700 years before Christ walks the earth, Isaiah says, yeah, the Jewish people aren't even going to accept this message. And he says, for he shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of dry ground. He has no form of comeliness. And when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire. There's really no form of majesty. He wasn't wearing royal robes, okay? He is despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised and we did not esteem him. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. Chastisement for our peace was upon him. And by his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. It goes on and on. It doesn't get any weaker. I mean, that he died in their place as their substitute for their iniquities, for their sins. This is where John the Baptist got the title Lamb for Jesus. Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. And you could see from John the Baptist's teachings that he probably spent a whole lot of time in the book of Isaiah. You could tell from Paul's writings that he probably spent a lot of time in Psalms. But does anybody know what the Orthodox Jewish spin on this Messianic prophecy is today? It's not really speaking of the Messiah. It's speaking of the nation of Israel. That the nation of Israel would suffer, but in the end, God would elevate her, would exalt her, would glorify her. Now, they do have justification for that, because there are times when the Messiah is called Jacob, which is Jacob's name was changed to Israel. There are times when the Messiah is straight out called Israel. And I also believe that it's like when Matthew quotes from Hosea, out of Egypt I have called my son, and so that was fulfilled when Jesus left Egypt as a baby and his family traveled back to the land of Palestine after Herod had died. Well, by today's hermeneutical principles, Matthew pulled the passage out of context. But that's why I think some of our hermeneutical principles are problematic. Because Matthew knew more about Hebrew hermeneutics, the Hebrew science of biblical interpretation, than our scholars do today. And what Matthew understood, and you'll find other places in Scripture, is that even the history of the Jewish nation itself is pregnant with prophecies and clues of the Messiah. So that when God called His people, His son, out of Egypt through Moses, that in itself was a prophecy that someday God's true son would be in Egypt, and then God would call him out and back into the promised land. So you can't slam the Orthodox rabbis for using that as a general principle.